Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. Morning. I'm excited to chat with Alex today. Good morning. This is the 99 Dev Problems show. I am unfortunately a little under the weather this morning and have been for the past couple of days, but we have an amazing guest with us today, and so we will not slow down. And I am super excited to bring on Alex. Alex, I would love for you to introduce yourself.
Absolutely, Tessa. Thanks. My name is Alex Burke. Been in the tech industry a little over a decade. Started in retail, mostly B2B companies. Worked for a local web shop for a little while. Transitioned into a bigger tech company. Was in Seattle for some time. And have made my way through a different startup and landed here at Shippium, the current startup I work for. And it's basically a reuniting of Zulily and Amazon Vets. So a lot of people that I have worked with in the past and some others that are new faces, but been here for about almost 3 years.
That is really fun when you get to work with a team that you've worked with before, assuming that they're a good team, right? But it's nice, yes, to have that kind of known connection and sort of understand people's, different ways of working and operating.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if I didn't like working with them, I wouldn't have come back.
yeah, exactly.
It's a great team. And oddly enough, almost the same small team that I was a part of at Zulily has reunited here. So we already work together. We kind of know each other. And of course, we've hired and added new people into that family, which is kind of the buzzword that people don't say. But very close, tightly knit team. So it's been a good time.
Oh, I love that. I mean, I think it's good to always have that like healthy work-life balance, but I also think that it's good to like build those really strong relationships with your coworkers, because it does make a very long portion of your weekday a lot more enjoyable when you can do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we have a good time. What's tough is, I worked in person with most of these people. I feel like if I hadn't had that, I don't know how I would have develop some of these relationships being in post-COVID. It's sure. I love working from home, but something different about having spent a couple of years working in person at desks, poking each other for help with things, pairing on problems. I guess we've adapted to doing that remotely, but it definitely strengthened the relationships I have with colleagues now being in person.
You know, that's a really beautiful thing to bring up. We talked a lot in pre-show, and I definitely want to dig into the tech stuff, but I want to double tap into what you just said, because I personally selfishly want to share a beautiful little memory I had this morning and just sort of ask you about yours, right? Is I think that there's something here with that office time, right? You have to get that time in. You have to, especially like as an engineer, like getting that sort of mentorship time in. For me, like I started as a freelancer, taught myself how to code, and then got a role in an actual job. And it was just so enlightening of like different ways of working, different ways of standardizing, different ways of thinking, because I taught myself how to code, you know? And so I think going into remote life is also very beautiful. I got to play with my son in the snow for the first time this morning, which was like, the most amazing thing.
Right.
And so if we are working in offices all the time, we don't necessarily get to enjoy moments like that. But at the same time, there is this beautiful fruitfulness in spending time with fellow engineers. I feel like you have a lot to share on that topic, both on the family side and the technical side. So I'll just leave that open-ended for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I can relate to the morning family time. I mean, this morning was pancakes and eggs and sausage, and we get to do that almost every day. Wake up early and the kids are up shortly after us. Hopefully, in theory, we have food for them when they wake up. Otherwise, it takes a little longer. But no kidding. Those connections wouldn't have happened pre-remote life for me. I had to be in the office at 7, 8, maybe 9, but I mean, never later than 9. And there's a commute, and would have missed out on hours on both ends of the day of time with the family. So we were lucky enough that we had kids post-COVID or middle of COVID. So they're still young, and they've not known the commuting dad life. So that's been a huge blessing. But yeah, to your other point, I built my, the beginning of my career was built on in-person relationships, in-person work, and a cadence of, you know, being able to ad hoc ask for question or ask for answers and ask for help with things, especially as a junior, you know, turning around my desk and asking somebody what was up with this legacy code that I was diving into, and maybe in a language that I hadn't even used. Spent some time in VB6 back in the day, and it was kind of on the end of its life, but you know, it was still around and working, but I didn't know what I was looking at. They don't teach that in college usually. So yeah, something, there's an unspoken openness when you're in person that people are just generally, if you're on a good team, they're open to you turning around and asking questions.
Yep.
You have to be really intentional and a self-starter when you're remote to make that happen. Yeah. Because you can't just turn around and ask a question. You have to interrupt somebody potentially in the middle of flow, or send them an email and hope that they have some time, book a meeting, start a Slack huddle. Everything is proactive. Everything has the potential to interrupt. And so it becomes this balance. And for me as well, like, I have to turn Slack off at sometimes. I have to turn it on at other times. I have to kind of structure my days around when I'm going to allow distractions, when I'm going to reach out to other people to distract them. And I'm not perfect, so I don't do a great job of that. But it's in the back of my head. I know that if I don't structure those things into my day, they're not going to happen. And it's the same for all of us. We're all kind of working together to figure out what that looks like.
Yeah, I agree. You know, as you were sharing that too, it really made me realize like how difficult it is when you join a new company to even just find a channel where you just feel safe to go ask a question. And it's not that it's like a feel safety thing that the company has made you feel unsafe. It's more that you're like, well, I don't want to dilute an important channel that has a meaningful conversation that is not related to that. And I don't see it, right? Or I don't want to bug someone who is in a channel that thinks that like, wow, this one's emergent or this one's, you know, right? You just don't ever quite know. Slack is an endless hole in some companies, or a very bare minimum in others, right? You never know what to expect. And I think it brings up the point of like, I really feel like especially in an engineering world, that it's like, if there was a channel that's just like, ask for help or just like get help, right? That's just so basic that takes away all of the pressure, like just everything that comes with, where do I ask a question? Where do I put this? How do I ask it? And it's just open-ended, like, hey, hitting my mic here because I'm all verbally, expressively talking. Long story short, you get the idea. Yes, right? And it's like, we need to make a safe space, even though a company isn't necessarily unsafe. It's just how we think and like how we operate. We don't want to bug our peers when they're in the flow, because we've been there, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a few thoughts on that, because I've experienced two very different approaches to try to solve that. I'd say kind of off the bat, I know that there's a lot of engineers, specifically the more experienced ones at my company, who will just turn off the presence mode in Slack. So there's no green bubble. Mm-hmm. It's dark. Like, we don't know if they're online or not. I think that's really
closet devs.
Exactly. For the people who need, and sometimes that's me, it depends on the week probably and the project, but
totally,
if you really need a block of multi-hour focus, you have to do that. You either have to turn off Slack and log out of it, or you have to go dark and proactively open it when you need it. Otherwise you're gonna see channels that you forgot you were a part of. You're gonna see mentions that accidentally include you because there's a Slack group that got tagged that you're a part of. It's constant. You know, that on top of the fact that you may have a phone in your pocket, it's just an unlimited number of ways to reach you that you don't need to distract you, that'll keep you from getting things done. So I think that's kind of a simple way to just turn it off at times. But so obviously we use Slack at Shippium. I think it's a great tool and it works really well for us. It's still a big distraction. So you have to, I think you really have to, each person has to figure out how to manage their presence in Slack. At my last company, a company called Uavionics, it's a hardware startup. Since has merged with another company and was probably the coolest job that I've had in my career. We were building the company was building micro electronics for aviation. So general aviation, GPS systems and drone systems, and actually has built some drones and then some other things I probably can't talk about, but really cool tech. And then I was building the software. So the company is mostly mechanical and electrical engineers or similar fields. And then a small handful of us that were doing software on top of that. So we were building a cloud system that remotely controlled drones, if you boiled it down to one sentence. It was awesome.
Dang. That really is
cool,
awesome.
Really cool work. We could talk about that at length. Obviously, I had a great few years there. Then the company changed a little bit. There was a merger.
Yeah.
And at that time, I got an awesome opportunity with Shippium. So made the change and joined my old team. But I still think that was probably the coolest job I've had. And the way that they handle presence and ad hoc communication is so different than like the big tech Slack industry. They're a no Slack company. There are no messaging platforms at that company that can like house information. Because as you probably know, Slack turns into a wiki. You search through your messages for that one document that you sent somebody a year ago, and it becomes your inbox.
And it's not conducive for that.
It's not conducive. It's not secure. It's not built for that. There's no real good way to organize and pull information at scale. So it just becomes this slog of another inbox that you have to search through and hope that their search function works the way you wanted it to.
I mean, that's kind of what it is for us. So
I think it's been that way everywhere I've used it. And I think that's probably the biggest downside to Slack is it becomes something it wasn't meant to do.
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
So not that was a great benefit of not having it. What we did at U of Yonex was they had a presence application that everyone had open at all times. And it was a small GUI window that I think there's a newer competitor that does something similar, but I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, everyone has their own little icon in a little desk in a picture of an office. And if the it's really funny and cute in a way, but if you're logged into it, which you're supposed to be when you're online, it shows your little emoji in your office.
Yep.
And if you're not logged in, it doesn't show you. So you know if somebody's working or not working.
Got it. So is that like VPN based? So it's like you're logged in and not logged in, or do you have to go into the GUI, log in every day?
You have to go in and log in, but it's, you know, it's a startup application. It just opens. So you don't actually have to click anything.
You're online. It's online.
Exactly. Now you can turn it off if you want to close it. But kind of the understanding amongst every team was, and it's a small company. Everyone's just supposed to be on there.
Yeah, totally.
And then it has audio and video as a part of the platform. So you can go in there, click on someone's office, and your emoji will enter their office and pop up an audio video channel like immediately.
That is adorable.
Now, I will say that part is so stressful because you'll hear the little like notification and you're in a call with whoever just entered your room.
Instant? You don't get to say no? Instant.
Yeah, no. You can't turn it off unless you close the application. So obviously like the video doesn't start without your permission. But that part's kind of,
I would not like great. That.
Yeah. But I will say that it does probably the best job that I can think of replicating the like turn around and ask somebody a question, feature.
I do like that.
Yeah. So it worked okay. It was, as I said, it was a very different model than the big tech
for sure.
Slack model and Zoom, and you know, everything is kind of manual. Mm-hmm.
That would be a perfect model though. Not to just jump in quick, but that'd be a perfect model if you could just reject and accept the call. Then it'd be perfect, right? Like as long as you give me a chance, like, hey, I'm in work mode, so I'm actually gonna reject your call, like pop in a little follow-up message, hey, I'm in the deep, right? Like schedule time with me or whatever, you know. I don't know.
And
it feels powerful.
It's been a few years. You could probably set those types of things up. It's,
oh, I'm sure,
you know, I remember there are notifications. I don't remember what I all had to click, but for sure there was a notification when someone entered your room. Maybe you had to like,
I'm sure AI could rebuild this. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. But it was an interesting concept and very different. So anyway,
yeah,
I will say that because that application was the main mode of like ad hoc communication, mm-hmm. there's a pretty high level of respect for people's time. And
totally.
For the most part, there was probably one or two exceptions, high in the company. Other than those exceptions, people didn't just jump in. Like
yep.
you would DM somebody first and there's a chat in it. You would chat and be like, hey, let's chat on this if you're free. And that's kind of how like peer-to-peer conversations happened. And because it was so instant, it was really easy to facilitate mm-hmm. those. And yeah. also everyone like had that respect of, I'm not just going to jump in and interrupt people. Everyone's like heads right. down, doing their work, getting stuff done. And the bar, I think, for interruptions was higher than yeah. a Slack Zoom model.
Totally.
And it also forced documentation and like general information to be stored more structured because you didn't have the
beautiful.
Slack option. There was no Zoom. There was yeah. no wiki. Everything we stored was either in a structured document or I'm trying to remember. Most of it was actual documents, Word docs, Excel files in the company, network storage, basically. A hand-rolled SharePoint kind of model.
Yeah.
But not Microsoft. Anyway.
I have a follow-up question
different.
For you. Yeah, super different. Okay, so I'm hearing this, right? And like, as I'm hearing this, I'm like, this is beautiful. And I think it really speaks to like different companies have different cultures and different ways of working, right? And it all comes down from that leadership, what they sort of instill. Snap had this beautiful thing called Council. Snapchat is what I'm referring to. Yeah. And apparently people got, they, it's not apparently, I was a part of it and it was beautiful. People got together in circles and you'd have very open conversations, but whatever was shared in that circle, which was called Council, you could not leave and tell anyone about, like you just couldn't. It was like
awesome.
A safe space. It was beautiful. And I'm sitting here and I'm sort of like, you're talking about this and I'm like, wow, I wonder, and I'd love to hear what you think about this. And then we should probably talk about what you do in your day to day. But I think
sure.
you and I, similar to many, could talk for a long time.
Yeah.
Do you think that now that we can build these different applications that sort of bring together bits and pieces more quickly via AI is basically what I'm alluding to, mm-hmm. you could probably build that infrastructure at which you are speaking to in like a half a day or a day if you knew exactly what you wanted and brought AI together. And a part of me is sitting here of like, are the tools like Slack and some of these other ones going to actually start to get cut out? Because they do have a ridiculously high price. And if it ends up being sort of this distraction, is there a more efficient way for us to be working? And are we going to see cultures and teams shift? Because I'm doing it personally in my own work. Now, I am a team of one, but yeah. I'm already starting to sort of mold and shift and wanting to remove things that cost money and just invest in the infrastructure at which I'm building. So curious what you think of that.
Yeah, good question. Hate to say it, but as anything, it depends, I think.
Totally. That's the true technical developer answer. It
right.
depends.
It's such a cop out. But so I'll say I think it aligns with my two experiences, the answer that I would offer.
At
U of Yonex, small company, not a software big tech company, more a hardware mm-hmm. company with software. I think they were already doing that. That's part of the reason we were using that tool. It's very inexpensive.
Yep.
It was a startup. There was a lot of resistance in many ways for good reason to things like, I don't want to throw all these companies under the bus, but you know,
no, totally.
Anything that
totally.
Does like observability and logging mm-hmm. and, even documentation and wikis, all of those like big tech offerings are wildly expensive. So there
yeah.
was resistance. We didn't have any of those at U of Yonex, and saved tens, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars, not
See?
Buying them.
Right.
So I totally think that there will be more of that going forward where people just are resistant to it. And on that note, I think open source has caught up a lot of ways with, mm-hmm. with you know, we because there was resistance to some of the, you know, big name offerings in those observability spaces, we used Grafana and Loki and Prometheus at Uavionics, yep. which was my choice. I was like, yeah, you're probably right. In our team meetings, like, we really don't need to spend this amount of, you know, the equivalent of an entire salary to get this offering. Let's just use the open source version. And we have plenty of experience. We'll just set it up, spin up some, you know, virtual machines and run it ourselves. And at certain scale, that's totally doable. I think if you get too big, you need a team or a dedicated person. So that's where I think it depends. The barrier to maintainability becomes a little bit more difficult.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that.
But we did fine with those open source offerings, and, you know, I got everything set up in a week, and then we used them with a lot of success. And there were 3 to 4 software developers on my team, and that was fine. We didn't spend a whole lot of time maintaining. So that was great. I think in the Shippium model, where we're a little bit bigger and it's a much more enterprise focused space, almost all of our customers are enterprise customers, and that's the market. The scale is vastly bigger, at least on the software side. It was, when you're doing hardware and embedded systems, you need software that supports that hardware, but we weren't targeting technology enterprise customers with a software offering as a service. So, you know, now I'm in B2B SaaS. It's a huge scale, millions and millions of events, or, you know, logging events or API requests, depending on the service, per second, per minute, per hour, per day, you know, it kind of varies, but everything's measured in millions. And managing, I could imagine spinning up those open source offerings, but you start by scaling vertically, but then you immediately hit an AWS cap, where the cost outweighs what you can just pick out of box with the big tech solutions. So,
yeah,
I think to summarize the answer, I think that smaller companies or one person solo devs or contractors at a certain scale would be better off for many years, depending on the scale, doing the open source thing or rolling their own or using the, you know, Linux offerings for things like logging. There's a lot of stuff you can just do without a big GUI. I think things will move that way, and probably already have started to move that way with the smaller startups. But I think because of the pain in scaling to millions, I think there will still be a huge market for the really expensive offerings. Just because you can spin it up faster and it works, and your engineers, whose time is really expensive and very valuable, don't have to worry about maintaining it. You may already have a DevOps team. We do here at Shippium. So they already know how to manage those things and can manage the paid out-of-box solution until maybe we roll our own if we need to. I think there's like, I feel like, and now I'm getting on a tangent, but I feel like Netflix has a lot of blogs, and like, you saw these things happen for them where everything was in-house and they rolled their own for like so long. And then at some point they moved to AWS. And I think I remember seeing that they have now moved a lot of stuff back out of AWS because it got too expensive. And now they have this mixed model of on-prem roll their own hand-rolled stuff, but they still have some things in AWS. That has been my experience here at Shippium. That was my experience at Zulily, which was where I worked before. I think I think it's going to go up and down for most companies as the scale continues to grow. If they're still alive and the scale continues to go up, I think things become cost prohibitive, where it was worth getting your startup off the ground with an out of the box solution. Eventually you're going to hit the point where the scale is so big, the cost is too much, and you go back to using your own solution.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I mean, that's how SaaS started, right? That's how all of these things even got to the place that they're at. What my brain is like really curious about, I think is probably the right word, is like, will AI supplement the ability to build things in-house in a way where it will see it more now? Because I do think that we are definitely seeing a shift in a lot of different directions. I'm seeing a lot of hardware stuff, which is super cool and exciting, especially after hearing your story. I had a client who was on the path towards robotics and hardware as their main use case. And really was really excited about that. Yeah. But long story short, I think that we're also seeing a shift away from cloud. I'm not saying that cloud is not the way, right? Cloud, you know, being sort of the Kubernetes and that being that beautiful, you know, overly complicated stack sometimes, but it's not always the answer. Sure. And so I think generally, and this is just my own hypothesis, both in personal life and professional life, I think humans are questioning everything at this point in time. And so it's sort of just this new space of like, who do I trust? What do I trust? What's actually the right answer? And we're sort of reforming our own hypothesis on how we want to live and operate.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I don't think I have anything to add, but to answer the question about AI, absolutely, it's going to help people move more quickly. I generally live more in the skeptic camp of these hype cycles. I'm very close with some people who are on the opposite end of the spectrum of both the crypto and the AI hype cycles. Yep. And so I can see both sides. I'm a cautious person in general, so that doesn't help. You know, I'm never going to be all in on the next hype cycle. That means I miss out on some things, but it also means I'm hedged against certain other things, like a crypto crash, for example. But with AI, for sure, it helps people move faster. I think the thing that's tough for me is I don't think it's ever going to be because by nature, what we have in the way of AI right now is not fully predictable and deterministic.
Yep.
There's always going to be a person who has to have the experience to judge what it outputs.
Yeah.
So this discourse about like AI is going to take your job is misleading in my opinion.
Yeah, I fully agree.
I think it's going to make some things much more quick. And to your point, you can get something out the door maybe much more quickly because it auto completes or it gives you some boilerplate or it gives you ideas about how to structure a class or a project, or it gets rid of your Webpack config because you forgot some syntax or some property in the documentation. You know, those types of things are great. Mm-hmm. It has removed the barrier to going and Googling something because it already was trained on that information.
Yeah.
But because it's not deterministic. And
properly Googling it, which has been a major pain point for developers, right? It's like, it was always the joke in the beginning when you become a developer, it's like, learn to Google things. Once you learn how to Google stuff. Exactly. Once you know how to search for the right things, you're good to go.
Exactly. So it's a new skill. How do you ask AI for exactly what you need and not get the wrong answers? But you still have to review the code. You still have to know what, like if you couldn't have written what it gave you, then in my opinion, you need to go figure out what it gave you.
Right.
Because that's where bugs and I mean, AI slop is kind of what everyone's referring to now. That's where it comes from. It's the same problem that Stack Overflow and Google gave us, but it's more scaled now and it comes faster.
Yep. I agree. Oh, wow. This has been such a good conversation. And like, I haven't even really dove into your day to day. So let's pivoting back to, sort of Shippium and what you do in your day to day. I'd love to hear more about that. Obviously, I've been at Zulily, you know, spent some time doing some cool hardware, you know, type of stuff, but in software. I should say you did software in hardware. That's the better way to term it. So what are you doing today? And like, what is sort of, what are some of the challenges you can share and some of the things that you're thinking about, either both technically from a stack or language standpoint to, you know, actual sort of challenges that you can share?
Absolutely. Yes. So I am on the front end team, which is great. It's full stack TypeScript. We manage what is the UI for Shippium. But because we're all TypeScript experienced, we have a pretty wide breadth of services under our team's management. So we have a lot of Node, we have a little bit of Bun, we have React, everything front end is React, but we've experimented with Remix. We have React Router, which has since swallowed Remix, but we have the pre-Remix React Router too. We've done a little bit of exploration into Tanner Lindsley's tool stack, tool set with React Query, and he now has TanStack Start. I did a little bit of investigation into that. We use Fastify in some of our services. What's great about being a startup is we get to explore what the best tool for pretty much every job is and decide how to solve it. So that's really great. We're a pretty senior team, which is good, but also means that the like number of things that we deal with is pretty significant. So I could spend a day doing DevOps work and fixing or building pipelines to get deployments out. I might be fudging with Nginx on a given day because we need to change a header size, or we need to add a location server to get some like subpath routed differently. But I also might spend my day building components in a React library or just general, you know, building a new page for our front end. And then all the way down to Node.js and APIs. Some of our APIs are like first class APIs that are customer facing. And some of them are more like gateway Node.js services that that pass UI traffic through to backend services on other teams, which is a pretty common like orchestration pattern. Yeah. So we have a few different models there, but tech stack, I spend a lot of time in TypeScript and then dealing with DevOps work, whether it's AWS services or pipelines. We use GitLab. So everything is like CI first class stuff, where you have a GitLab file and you basically tell it what to do. And then you have either bash scripts or Docker images or a combination usually of all of that. And eventually it ends up in AWS hosted infrastructure, which the list is, you know, in long. So that's like the tech answer. In terms of what we're doing, the main UI that we offer is called our partner console. And it's basically the way that our customers configure and interact with their fulfillment network within our system. So Shippium as an offering is a way to set up multi-carrier accounts, things like FedEx and DHL and UPS and USPS and CDL. And, you know, there's a list, many long. I don't know if I can say how many we support, but you can imagine hundreds that exist in just the United States. And
for sure,
we are now outside of the US. So we have a huge offering of carriers that we support. And that's one of our big products. It's carrier selection. So
I love that.
A customer will use our UI to set up all of those accounts and configure how they want them to interact. There's some mapping code that they can look at a map and see where on the map their different fulfillment centers are and how they interact with each other. So, you know, a lot of code to handle all those different things. Some of it, we go anywhere from like boilerplate form code all the way to mapping and charts and reporting. And it's very data intensive because we're dealing with huge volumes of shipments and carrier interactions and tracking, of course, which is event-based. You get tons of events and all of that has to be analyzed and touched by backend systems. And then eventually UI does some type of presentation, whether it's a report or changing what they actually want to be configured around those fulfillment centers and network operations, or generating like on the fly reporting based on historical data. That's kind of one pretty wide reaching part of our business. We have another product called Simulation, which has been really popular with customers. We're basically using N number of historical shipments or fulfillment locations, et cetera, et cetera. Things like delivery times and like times in transit between two locations, all of that data comes into play. They can input that data into our system and then use it to simulate future results. So
that's cool.
Yeah. Like at its most basic description, they're inputting tons of historical data and they get reports and analysis on what it will look like for the next month, for the next 6 months, for the next year.
That's helpful.
Hey, so like a big use would be like, I want to change one thing. Sure. Let's say I want to open up a new warehouse in Nevada. And I want to see what it's going to look like if I add that to my fulfillment network and then push a million shipments through it. They put that into the system. They see what rate shopping might look like. You know, what kind of prices based on historical data, what kind of prices might I get from my big carrier accounts? And where can I save money? Where am I going to lose money? How can I make adjustments to my entire network so that I'm maybe
more profitable, you know,
off the top of my head, maybe you want to save $1 per whatever 1,000 shipments or, you know, something random. You can make a bunch of tweaks and see what it might look like based on the data that you've seen in the past. And it's easy money, you know. You make changes to your network. You don't have to enforce those changes. You can simulate what it might look like and that's repeatable. And you found a way to save millions of dollars. Okay, let's make it live. Let's configure this new fulfillment network, or let's add a new carrier account, or we're going to change the prioritization of a certain shipping method. All that kind of stuff, which people historically would do with Excel files or, you know, on the
data scientists and
floor data science, running models in-house. Now they can just do a simulation, which, you know, does take some work, but they can see it without affecting their bottom line immediately.
Yeah, for sure.
And then now they know what the changes could look like. They can put it into production and have that knowledge and save money. So a lot of it is cost savings, and it's huge because when you get to a scale of millions of shipments, it only takes a few cents and you're saving millions of dollars.
Right. And on top of that, it sounds like if they care about this, not that all companies do, but if they care about this, customer service can also be an element of this, right? So you could start to pre-configure, how do we get shipments into customers' hands quicker or in a more efficient way, right? If they're just down the street, why are we sending it all the way to the next metro city through the U.S. Postal Service when it can go through a local service? Yeah. Dang. Absolutely. I love that. Okay. Very cool.
Yeah. So, so that's most of what we do. We have some other products, to your point about delivery guarantees, estimated ship dates, estimated delivery dates, because of the quantity of data and the fact that we have models running around that, we have found that we can make, we have a basically our whole business model is around a delivery promise. You as a customer, amazing. You as a business should be able to promise your customers when things are going to be delivered. And using carrier data, that historically is not possible. Carriers, the big carriers have time in transit data that they update frequently and basically gives you an estimate of days between certain zip codes. You can imagine a huge Excel file going from zip code in California to zip code in Boston.
Without thinking about anything going on in the economics or societal world either.
Exactly. And because we have more data and can run it through models and we have it spread across many carriers, we are a lot more accurate. And so that's a huge, huge part of it is your customers want to know when they're going to get a package. They want to get it fast and they also want it to be right. And so that's a huge part of our offering is you can do that. And with just carrier data, you miss that a lot.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Super cool. I'm trying to think where to even take that. That is it. Sure. That's fun. Okay. Hold on. I'm trying to think through my normal questions. I have sick, foggy brain. Okay. So have there been any major technical challenges that you've had to solve? And if so, what was your path to solving them? You don't have to explain all the tech. Obviously there's some proprietary things you obviously can't share. But curious more about your problem solving technique and then, you know, how you sort of landed at that resolution.
Sure.
I know that's a hard question. Yeah, sometimes it's crystal clear and sometimes it's like, wait, every single day, I don't know which one you want to talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I have a number of answers that come up. I will say that I'm not sure if I can share most of them, but I will say, I think we actually have a public case study with MongoDB. Has been a huge positive for us. We use Mongo pretty heavily. And just to be on the safe side, I won't go into a ton of detail, but we have had to change the way that we scale Mongo behind the scenes. We've had to deal with things like sharding.
With your data models.
Yeah, I mean, we've had to solve what would basically be a system design question in most interviews because we're running at that level of scale. And that's been a pretty interesting problem. A lot of that started as I was joining and then has continued, but databases as a whole don't deal with huge quantities of data. I mean, you can choose any database. They aren't really mostly built to scale into the hundreds of millions and up and up. So we've had to do things like sharding, things change the way that we store data, offload workloads, do things asynchronously. Those have been really interesting problems. I will say that my team isn't doing most of those, but we're certainly involved. Mostly back-end teams dealing with that kind of thing. But that's probably the most relevant, interesting thing I can think of that I know for sure I can talk about.
Yeah. Well, I love that you brought that up. I think Mongo, you know, there's some great people over there and they have a really great product. And I think, not to speak poorly at all about them, I think they're great, right? I wanted to say most because I do think that it's kind of interesting. And this is the reason I love these conversations is like the more that developers can have these conversations, the more we can learn about different technologies and different solutions. So when I said most in my head, I was like, you got to check out HarperDB, which is one of my clients. Nice. And it's just one of those things, right? Of like, we all have these different technological challenges. Let's see if I can talk this morning, but we have different ways that we solve them, right? We have an investment that we make to different tools. So we continue to make those investments. Then there are other tools that do, you know, sort of the same jobs, but differently. We're like, on pre-show, I was telling you about HarperDB because for that reason is that they actually specialize in extremely scalable databases with expansive data for e-commerce specifically. And I won't get into the whole tech stack mostly because I don't fully understand it, but what I do understand and know is just how it operates in its infrastructure, and that it can actually do that read data extremely quickly, because what you can do is actually through just modern JavaScript, go in and actually set where you want these various cache layers to exist. So it'll pull in that data, supply it for you, maintain that data, and sort of work through different operations at which it can essentially make it more performant. There's a lot more to it, but I just wanted to drop that there. I don't get a chance to talk about my clients very frequently, especially when it's like a very nerdy niche use case like this. But still, nonetheless, I think it's awesome that your team has also realized this was a challenge and solved it through MongoDB, which if anyone has used that, right, beautiful tool to use as well. So many tools in our toolboxes.
Yeah, no, that's cool. I haven't heard of HarperDB. I'll definitely check them out. Do you happen to know, are they a like brand new from scratch? They built their own database. Are they backed by a specific platform? Can you say any of that?
Yeah. So, okay. I would say it if I could, if I knew all of it, but like, you know, it's that thing of like, I know what I know, but I don't want to speak to the exact stack at which it was built. Some things I have context on, but long story short, they're not new. They were actually a client of mine, like way back in like 2020 when I was living in Denver. They're out of Denver. They met me then, and they were very early. And so at that early stage, they were more like a Mongo competitor, but still had this efficiency and this performance focus. And so I was helping them with just DevRel. So it was mostly coaching, guiding their team on sort of how to build up a developer brand. And then they re-tapped in because I asked them for a quote for my business this last year. And basically the CEO was like, we got to bring it back, Tessa. Like if this is what she's doing, which Steven, shout out to you. Yeah, you're awesome. Appreciate the love. Yeah, but now they have found tons of enterprise success, like with Fortune very low that I cannot mention, and been able to do that through this enterprise approach, but they very much need the developer self-serve love. And so that's actually what we're working on now, is like improving those docs, improving that experience so that a developer like you, who is still building these beautiful enterprise, you know, extremely kind of cutting edge technology solutions for the enterprise, can still find those tools. And so that is why they are a client. But I can get you the answer in the infrastructure, because there is a couple sort of one proprietary bit that's in there that's, I think it's Lime something, but I'll get you the actual specs on it. It's funny because this week I'm diving into building sort of a tutorial and kind of a little like example to like show devs, this is the aha moment that makes them different from another database, right? And so that's a pretty fun project. So yeah. Anyways, let's digress about me just, you know, spilling on my clients, but I do think it's a beautiful opportunity when I can talk about it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. Okay. So we got to talk about a lot of personal life stuff too. I try to end these at 10:45, but it like never happens. I tried for 10:30 in the beginning. That was crazy. And I'm talking central. I'm not sure.
Lofty.
You're in Eastern. So yeah, exactly. I would love, if you're open to it, to talk about your personal life and just some of your beliefs and how that comes into play. I believe what you believe fundamentally, I think. We didn't talk about every single value and moral. Anyways, if you're open to it, I would just love to talk about sort of personal life and how I think that played into your decisions to join Shippeum and, you know, the goodness you shared in the pre-show.
Absolutely. Yes. No, would love to talk about it. So I'm a Bible-believing Christian. Obviously, we didn't talk about the specifics in the pre-show, and we don't need to, but because, you know, how many things that could mean these days. Christianity could be any number of things after you dive into it. But we try to follow the Bible in our household. Yeah. And, you know, it means we have a moral standard. And, you know, it colors how we raise our children. And for sure, it helps me decide where I'm going to work, who I'm going to work with, you know, how I'm going to behave and interact with other people, you know, having respect for colleagues. To answer your question about how I ended up joining Shippeum, I think my biggest, the biggest weight that I play or that I place on a new company decision is around the people. Mm-hmm. And
same.
Luckily, I already knew a lot of the people at Shippium. We worked together at Zulily, and the opportunity came up at a perfect time. But having those relationships and that level of respect already, having worked together at Zulily, and you know, starting the conversation about the opportunities they had for me was pretty much a no-brainer. It was very easy to join. Already had, you know, a mutual trust and knowledge of skills and what we could do together. And so,
yeah,
I love. I'm all in on the tech and the software offering and the company and our mission. And you know, I have my supply chain now, which is in on one hand hilarious, but you know, also, you know, I'm all in on it. So it's a cool thing. Yes. But the reason I joined is because of the people. It's a great team. My small team, my individual front end team is great. There's as I said, we're pretty senior heavy, which is always fun. You know, everyone has a lot that they can offer and a wide variety of different experiences. None of us is, each of us has some expertise in areas that others don't, which is great for working together. And then across the company, we have such a wide ranging level of experience. A lot of people from Amazon, a lot of people from Zulily, pretty deep supply chain roots. So everyone
that's amazing.
For the most part, everyone has been in supply chain for many years, if not many decades. So, you know, the problems that we're solving have either already been solved in the past by these people in different ways, or the solutions are in some ways known, or the problems are known, and therefore we can do a good job of providing the solutions. So it's really cool. You learn a lot kind of all the time if you know where to look and where to listen.
Yep.
But definitely came here for the people and have stayed because of the people.
Yeah. I love that. I think, you know, and you and I talked about this in pre-show, and I'll very openly say this, is like, I've been a Christian my whole life, but only because God's been chasing me, which is a whole nother beautiful story that I've absolutely love and love to share. But most recently within the last like 5 years have been like, oh, hey, I see you chasing me. I got you. And have reciprocated, and definitely try to live by the Bible as well. I'd like to say it's a progressive version. It's not necessarily progressive, but I think it's my version that just puts everyone's heart first, right? It's like, that's like the love thy neighbors. Like that's what I try to live by. Right. And so I think that in tech, you know, it's not always easy to talk about these things. I have been very judged for my, you know, Christianic beliefs, and I understand it, right? We all have different understandings of different groups and what have you. But I feel like it's sort of time to, you know, maybe stop hiding it as much as I have been, and unveiling it, just because I really think that it is who I am. And if someone does respect or enjoy, you know, being around me, it doesn't mean they have to be a Christian, but if I can help someone, you know, find their way, if that's the way, or find their way because maybe it's the other way. Like, that's all my heart cares about. And so I just thought it was you came in, and it's just very serendipitous. The last few of my guests and also been believers. And so I don't know, in my heart, there's something here that's like, hey, yes, you know, we can be somewhat labeled, but I'd like to believe the ones of us who are truly the I don't want to say that we're even good believers, but we are the true disciples, right?
Yes.
We're on the good side, and I'd love nothing more than the whole world to just love each other. So,
yeah, disciple is a fun word. That was kind of taboo in the 90s and 2000s. People it was disciple. Saying disciple was different than Christian. Yeah. They're not different. It's just kind of the label we gave that word for so long. Yeah. But disciple of Jesus is a follower of Jesus. But I totally agree with what you said. There shouldn't be a reason to hide these things in the same way that you shouldn't hide your other beliefs. I mean, if you're not a Christian, you have some type of belief system.
Yep.
Feel free to share that.
Absolutely.
What's tough is this is a whole can of worms, but I think
it is
our country, the United States, claims to be founded on the Christian ideal.
That's but, a deep conversation.
Yeah, but our country is not Christian. Just no. Because everyone likes to talk about the fact that they have a Bible or that
in
they
God went we to trust church.
Yeah. In God we trust, one nation under God, which has probably been removed from a lot of schools, but, you know, whatever. Whether or not that's in the school doesn't affect our discipleship or our Christianity.
It does not.
But, you know, those types of things where we have tried to first mix church and state, but then also like claim that our country is Christian and that God loves America. Yeah. That's not how God operates.
Yep. Pick up the Bible.
God is way outside and way bigger than our man-made political divides and political ideas and, you know, two-party system and our small little country in the, you know, expanse of an 8 billion person planet. Like it's so contrived and egotistical to say that like we're God's country, because that's just not that's not how God operates. God wants us, he wants a relationship with us, and you can find out a lot about God's character and Jesus's character in the Bible, but it's not going to talk about America. And I think that's part of like what has turned so many people off to people talking about the Bible, talking about Jesus, or talking about Christianity in the workplace or just in life in general, is those things have become mixed, and we've pulled the God card in places that it should not have been pulled. God is not our tool. God made us. If you believe in God and you believe in what the Bible says about him, then he is not your tool to use and direct. It's so backwards. And you know, that's turned into things like hate and things like people call it judgment or feel judged or just those exceptions that have given such a bad name to God are not what God has intended for his creation. He did not make us to tear other people down. And I mean, to your point,
he did not.
Jesus said that the number one and number two commands, love God with all your heart, love your neighbor as yourself. And if Jesus thought those were the most important, I mean, to have the Son of God, if you believe that, wash his disciples' feet is such a perfect metaphor for how God expects us to treat other people. And I think in some ways we've lost that. In other ways, it was never there in a lot of places.
I think in the times that you're talking about, it was never there, right? They were using what I think is cultural Christianity to sort of validate decisions and things that were made, because it likely was, you know, deeper in the roots. And we can have a whole conversation, because there's always been some toxic form of Christianity, right? That's even in the Bible. It's like immediate and it happens. I think that my my daughter, I feel like if you are, I mean, obviously there are those that, you know, don't believe in, you know, the Jesus kind of side of things and still our fundamentals are still in the same place. We still believe that, you know, there is God. But my daughter has this adorable book. I can't remember what it's called, but I will see if I can put it in the show notes. It almost makes me like want to cry because it's such a beautiful book. Basically, it's a kid's book, and it's like, it's so good. And so it's like, it talks about why God's beautiful plan is essentially the whole premise of the book. And so it talks about how God had this plan to create all of these humans, to put them on earth together so that they could love each other, they could repopulate, we would live in community, we would live together supporting one another. And then it talks about how God's plan has been destroyed, essentially, and how people don't wow. live in community. They don't love each other's neighbors. And it's such a clear visual for children, right? Boom, like, whoa, this is obviously not the intended purpose of this world and his creation. And then it speaks to like Jesus coming back and what Jesus did and how much he gives, you know, for his people and how he goes back, right? Because the whole precedence, or, you know, obviously precedent of Jesus coming back is like to allow us to feel, I think, some of the tensity that we felt in all the generations, but most recently, I think, around this, like, being perfect, the no sinning, like, we absolutely can't sin. And I think, obviously, that's why Jesus came back. That's why we have the New Testament, right? We've got a bit more of forgiveness that God realized that we are sinning humans. And so the book speaks to that and then essentially comes back. And it's like one day, obviously, like, if you've read the Bible, you know that there's a day when Jesus is going to come back for us. And but essentially the book talks about, it doesn't matter what stage that you're in. It doesn't matter where you're at. Like, God's beautiful plan was for us to live together and to love each other. And I think it's just, every time I read it, and I read it with my kids quite a bit, it's like just a little tear, because that, like, that's the world right. like I want to see us living in. And I just,
so good.
And I feel like more than anything that I think those of us who believe that and whose hearts are in that space, I just think it's important for us to talk about that, because I don't care what you look like or your values or who you are or the decisions that you've made in your past. I care about you feeling loved and you giving love for the rest of whatever your life looks like, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. I think you think about how Jesus treated people, and, you know, some of this is, I think, where we can miss the mark. Jesus, there's, well, I don't know. I feel like I grew up knowing how hard Jesus was on the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Yeah. And like
cultural Christianity, in certain places. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you read about him overturning tables in the temple, and you read about him calling the Pharisees a brood of vipers. And I mean, he rebukes them time and time again. But I feel like, and maybe this was just me, but as a young kid, I missed the fact that those are the teachers of the law mm-hmm. who agree with who God is and were trying to follow God to the best of their ability. Therefore, it was right for Jesus to call them to that higher standard.
Yes.
But who are we to ask our atheist coworker mm-hmm. or our agnostic friend or our, the Jew in our neighborhood, expect them to follow the standard that we believe in.
Right.
That's not what God has asked us to do. And the whole Old Testament is that story. God's people are separate and holy, set apart. And he asks them to follow a standard. And there, especially in, I believe, Deuteronomy, it talks about welcoming in the foreigner. You need to welcome in the foreigner and invite them into your community. Mm-hmm. But they are, in the same way that we live in today's society, we aren't expecting them. We should not be expecting them to live to the standard that they didn't sign up
yes.
for.
Yes.
Like, we're Christians, and part of our discipleship is to make other disciples and is to teach them how God wants to love them and how he wants them to love others. And so evangelism and sharing that message is a part of our life, but expecting somebody to live to that standard if they haven't signed up mm-hmm. for it is not correct.
Yep. Oh, I love that so much. And I think that is likely where I think a lot of hate has come into, you know, this kind of side of religious views, right, is the sort of expectations of, I believe this, so you should believe this. And I think it's very crystal clear in the Bible that, like, that is not what we are supposed to be doing, right? We are supposed to be loving. If it's a fellow Christian, different situation, right? But we are supposed to be loving and welcoming. Yeah, exactly. Because they're the same standard as ours. So, well, I could keep talking about this for like a long time. I am so appreciative to the listeners who have stuck by this part. Whether you believe or you don't believe, I still love you. And I think that's the beauty of it, right? Yes. And that's, you know, for me is like, every single day, it's a fight to be more like Jesus. And I just need that reminder of like, hey, maybe I just have to go wash some feet.
Absolutely. Well said and agreed.
Okay. Before we go, Shippium, and don't mind my like little tear. I like the Holy Spirit really lives in me. So like anything related to this, there's emotions with it and it's beautiful. Very beautiful.
It. And there should be. It's great.
Shippium, let me rephrase this. They might be hiring. Would you like to tell us about that?
Absolutely.
Okay, awesome. Let's chat about that.
Yes. My team specifically is hiring. We're looking for a front-end developer to TypeScript stack. Mm-hmm. We're open to, it's a remote position. It's a pretty, I'm biased. It's a pretty awesome gig. The position is amazing. The team is great. Very collaborative, very kind, thoughtful team, and unfairly experienced, if I do say so myself.
So a stacked load of mentors. Love it.
Yes. And we have a ton of autonomy and a lot of freedom. Beautiful. We are constantly evaluating new technology, new solutions. The handful of us on the team get to decide our fate. So it's a really cool spot to be in. And you don't need supply chain experience, but of course that does help. Sure. But we're really looking for the front end experience. And most of that is TypeScript, mm-hmm. whether it's Node.js or React. You're going to spend a lot of time in
both. Okay, awesome. What other, are you looking for a specific experience level? I know that's kind of that's a hard question. It sort of depends, but, let's fill in a couple other spots. So maybe there's some folks that would better understand, hey, that's a good role for me.
Yes, it is. I would categorize it as a mid-level position. Great. This is not going to be somebody who has decades of senior level experience.
Okay, awesome.
But it's probably also not fresh out of college.
Okay.
But I will say there's not a specific rule around that. We're just looking for somebody who has either a ton of hunger and aptitude, and or somebody who has a handful of years or really good quality experience.
I love that answer. That's amazing. Okay, fabulous. I will link that in the show notes, so I'll have you send that to me and share with the listeners here and anyone who might listen in the future. This will also go in podcast.
And I think it's, if you click on my profile, I think I have it linked as well. But also,
perfect.
The link to the job listing too.
Awesome. Well, we will get that added either way. Where can folks find you if they would like to chat with you or reach out to you directly?
Absolutely. So I'm kind of new to being terminally online, but I have LinkedIn, of course. I do have a Twitter X account. And I don't know what else exists these days.
Mm.
I guess my Instagram is private, so probably don't look for that. But I believe I am Alex C. Burke on everything that I have. So LinkedIn, X, GitHub.
That's the huge for devs, honestly.
Yeah, that's probably the only place you need to look. But I do own my domain. I just don't really use it. Alex C. Burke everywhere. It's pretty straightforward.
I love that. This has been an amazing conversation. Thank you, everyone, for sticking with us a little bit later today. Honestly, we've had an influx of viewers, not a departure. So that's a beautiful thing. So thank you so much for being on the show, Alex. This has been such a great conversation. I am eternally grateful that you are now in my inner circle.
Totally agreed. It was great to meet you, Tessa. It was an excellent conversation.
Let's absolutely do it again. All right, folks, we're signing off. Throw up some prayers for me that I can keep things where they're supposed to be and they start getting better.
Definitely. Yes. All right. Have a great day.
Have a great day.
See y'all.